This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You may have heard that George Washington had a full set of wooden teeth that he carved himself. Well, it is a myth. He had several sets of dentures, one made of ivory, which, if stained brown by food and red wine, may have appeared to be made of wood grain and started a rumor that turned into a myth. Our first president's poor teeth were likely the result of bad genes and the rather primitive techniques of 18th century dentistry. Back then, it was common, even for government leaders or aristocrats, to have missing, crooked, and stained teeth. Today, having bad teeth could be an indicator of other serious health issues and of socioeconomic status. In fact, the income gap between those with good and bad oral hygiene has grown, along with the stigma surrounding those with unsavory teeth. Sarah Smarsh is a journalist. She's a public speaker and educator and wrote for Eon Magazine about the difficulty of having poor teeth in America. Sarah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello.
Your essay about who has access to dental care begins with your own family. Let's say among the have-nots as far as getting good care is concerned. And you tell the story of your grandmother who at 35 had a full set of dentures. What happened there?
Actually, by the time she was in her late 20s, she did have indeed full dentures. She was 35 when I was born, and so that might be the age that you're noting. She, like many people of the sort of classes that we're discussing, had essentially her teeth went so long without proper care that eventually it was surmised, I don't know whether wisely or not, that the best approach to healing her toothaches and teeth woes was to extract every one of them and just give her a set of dentures. And so before she was 30, she was wearing dentures. And this would have been in the 60s. That might sound like, oh, that was decades long ago enough that that's of a different era. But in fact, since publishing that essay, I've received hundreds of emails and from people who, by and large, relate to my story on some level, and many of them were connected specifically with that storyline about my grandma's dentures and attested to the fact that there are people in their own families today who are receiving that sort of treatment.
Well, your grandmother sounds like a pretty sassy woman, the way that you sort of describe her, but your essay actually talks about the cost, the psychological cost of having poor teeth in this country. What would you say that is?
Yeah, we began this conversation by focusing, and I think rightly, on just the physicality of teeth and the health problems that might stem from the mouth. My own dad, as I mentioned in the essay, also had a brush with death because of essentially blood poisoning that stemmed from infection in his mouth that went untreated. So these things are paramount, and that's the stuff of survival. There is an undercurrent of a different sort of harm that comes with poor teeth, and that is the psychological one that you bring up. And there have been countless psychological and sociological studies indicating the importance of teeth as a visual cue by which we judge our fellow human beings. And right or wrong, that very much is the case. And so a person with teeth that represent her poor upbringing will be disadvantaged on the job market, in social settings, in romantic settings, and in all sorts of ways that people might not even be aware of consciously.
The assumption people often make about bad teeth, that this person didn't eat well, they don't take care of themselves, or it's indicative of a drug problem like a meth head. So there's a kind of element of blaming or even shaming the victims. You know, what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that I, in bearing witness to some present-day conversations with my dad and grandmother in the essay, tried to reveal how much guilt and self-blame that they carried about the condition of their teeth. And I also talk about the great pride that I took my whole life in taking care of my teeth, which I was very fortunate to have grow in favorable ways and genetically somehow. But so there certainly is some onus on the individual. But I know absolutely that having had experiences with very painful, untreated situations, particularly with my baby teeth when I was young and under the care of other people, that there are many circumstances that account for one's dental condition that are far outside of the individual's control. And those, so far as I can tell, almost always go back to money. And so I think that it's one of the common tropes would be, well for sure, you cite meth teeth, quote unquote, and that's a familiar phrase now. And it is a real thing, but it's much more, you know, there is a much more day-to-day kind of commonplace blaming on too much sugar or the nutrition isn't right or these people aren't taking care of their teeth. They're not brushing their teeth and that's why they have these problems. And what I have seen is that when all other things are equal, what it amounts to is who can afford to go to the dentist in many cases. And so there are a lot of other factors that play into this, whether water is fluoridated and there are all sorts of controversies swirl about these sorts of systems that affect our teeth. But ultimately, there is an idea, I think, that someone whose teeth look bad or pain them, that's the individual's fault. And that's a convenient belief for us to subscribe to as a culture because it precludes any of us from acknowledging our own privilege and being able to access a system that keeps our teeth healthy.
I'm speaking with a Kansas-based journalist, Sarah Smarsh, and she wrote an article in Aon magazine about poor teeth, meaning quite literally those people who have mouthfuls of teeth shaped by a childhood, often in poverty, and a lack of access to dental health care as children and adults. Well, this is a sign of my own privilege. I think that I have dental care through my job, medical care as well, and was shocked to hear that dental care is not generally covered by Medicare and not included in the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. Was it supposed to be? Was it ever?
The earliest incarnations of the Affordable Care Act did include dental coverage. That was something that was kind of fell on the chopping block during the process of compromising it to the ACA that we know now. Then that fell to state-level governments, essentially, then to figure out how to handle dental care for the poorest among their population. States were provided with the option of whether to expand Medicaid through federal subsidies. Kansas and many other states decided not to do so. And so most of the working poor in Kansas are left now, and in many states, are left now with versions of state-level plans that essentially will cover a cleaning every 6 months or year and then emergency-level extractions.
Well, another assumption on my part that when we heard about connection between bad dental care or bad dental health and health issues like diabetes, like heart disease, I always assumed that it was an indicator of, well, you're poor. You know, you can't afford dental care, therefore you can't afford to eat well, therefore you can't afford, you know, you eat too much sugar, that kind of thing. But as it turns out, bad dental care is actually causing these diseases. And A lack of access to basic dental care has become a contributing factor to the high cost of health care in America. Mm-hmm. So what's behind that?
Yeah, I would love to know. I didn't research this deep enough to become an expert on the reason why dental care is regarded as some kind of separate entity on so many levels than general health care. But I think that's at the heart of your question. Are our teeth somehow secondary to the rest of our body? And as you point out, of course, no. In fact, they are part of our bodies and often a really crucial part that is the kind of ground zero for health problems many times, as opposed to just the symptom of problems elsewhere in the body. And so many times individuals will end up in emergency rooms having essentially healthcare emergencies, being treated for, say, sepsis, poisoning of the blood because of infected teeth that went untreated, or other ailments that are rooted in the mouth. And those emergency room visits, which number almost a million annually in this country, that stats from a couple of years ago, but I imagine hasn't changed much. These are essentially brushes with death that people are having, that where the rest of the body is finally absorbing problems that started in the mouth and were kicked down the road by our healthcare system. I think that sometimes there is a sense of the mouth as being entirely cosmetic, and it has a much more important function than just looking good.
Just thinking about outlook and the way I view the world, I have relatively good teeth. I never, I come from a big family, the bottom of a big family, had a lot of cavities when I was growing up. But I smile a lot. I've had smile lines since I've been about 20. And I'm just trying to think about how I would be in the world if I were shielding a smile all the time. What do you think that does to a person?
Yeah, I don't know how far psychological studies have delved into this, but I know from just my own, the case study that is my family, that my dad would be an example of someone who is, he's hilarious and he's a very good-humored gentleman. And he has, in the process of talking to him for this essay, he confessed that he is, extremely self-conscious about his teeth. Which comparatively aren't all that bad, but they would probably look much different in the mouth of a man with more money. And he's very self-conscious about it, and his the way that he thinks about how he smiles. If I'm sure that all of your listeners remember some moment from childhood when they were missing teeth, as one does during that process when the baby teeth are falling out and the permanent teeth are coming in, and there is often a self-consciousness and an awkwardness that comes with that. If that sense might be, the stakes for, your own self-awareness of the way that you're judged are raised by the job market and romantic interactions and all the high social stakes that we live in as adults. Imagine that sense in childhood of self-awareness and missing an eye tooth and waiting for the permanent one to grow in, being that exponentially more potent and knowing that is also likely permanent. There's no hope for something different growing in. It's the smile that you have, and people learn quickly how the people around them respond to that smile, and they carry themselves accordingly. And I'm sure that is a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy then sometimes in whether one is able to project a certain level of confidence, and then the returns one gets from society.
Well, Sarah Smarsh, a fascinating topic, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Sarah Smarsh, she's a journalist, public speaker, and educator, and her work has appeared in Harper's, The Guardian, and many other publications. You can find her piece on poor teeth in Eon Magazine. There's a link to it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And stick around for more word of mouth. Up next, we're going to hear from a New Hampshire music teacher who set himself on an epic task, teaching elementary school kids how to listen. His story when word of mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Part Mythbusters, part Blue Man Group, and part Bill Nye the Science Guy. That's Mike Alberici's program Sound in Focus, which teaches kids to listen, which is a real challenge in American classrooms. Mike, a music teacher, decided to do something about it, and his efforts have taken him to elementary schools across New Hampshire. Word of Mouth intern Fiona Shea has the story.
That was the sound of a vortex cannon going off in the Lamprey River Elementary School in Raymond, New Hampshire. Don't worry, it only shoots air and smoke. And more importantly, it's a fun experiment that teaches kids the science of sound and how to listen.
My name is Mr. Alberici. Let's try to say my name. Al.
Alberici.
Mike Alberici is a music teacher at Maple Street School in Hopkinton. Mr. A, as he's known to many students, is the only music teacher to ever receive the Kristen McAuliffe Sabbatical from the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, an award that grants teachers leave to develop new ideas for the classroom and covers all the costs. As a musician and a teacher who's been teaching for 23 years, he has an ear for the way kids talk, and the way kids listen and interact. And a few years ago, he realized that there was a problem.
It was around 2007 or 2008, when Apple released the iPod Touch.
He says that was the first time kids really had the internet in their pockets.
And I started noticing then that they're listening. First, their attention span, their listening attention span started to tank within a couple of years. Like, I used to be able to put on like a movement of a Beethoven symphony. And with the right pre-teaching, I could get a class of 20 kids to listen quietly for 9 minutes. By 2010, I noticed that kids were unable to do that.
They were fidgeting. They were drawing. They were reaching for electronics. They were chatting. They couldn't sustain just listening. This tendency to get distracted, Mike calls it swiping behavior, as though kids are treating life as they would an iPad.
If they don't like what you're saying, swipe, you're done. Move on to the next thing. I don't like this music, swipe, you're done.
And so, with the help of the sabbatical, he developed a program called Sound in Focus, a 4-day residency he conducts in schools across the state designed to teach kids how to be mindful listeners and better communicators. But how do you get kids who aren't listening to pay attention?
I knew that on day one, I needed to build some over-the-top sound experiments to show these kids just how incredible sound is. Because my focus is, I want to inspire them to listen. So I said, okay, we need to inspire them. How do you inspire a fifth grader to listen? You blow his mind.
With his newest musical instrument, a tubulum made out of PVC pipe, Mike not only shows that music and sound can be cool, but also stresses the importance of math. He tells the kids how he couldn't build the instrument without math, but he couldn't do the equation and needed his daughter's help.
Math is everything in the world. Okay, so listen up when your teachers start doing math. That's a word from me to you. Listen.
Day one is when Mr. A breaks out the vortex cannon we heard earlier, and also when the kids try to break the quiet record, a record for being, well, silent. Mike gives the kids 15 seconds to be as quiet as possible.
We're trying to break the record of 55. To break it, you have to get 54.
To break the record, these kids had to reach an average quietness of 54 decibels.
One, two, three.
This is the sound of 200 kids being absolutely silent. Well, until...
54, you did it. Yeah!
On days 2, 3, and 4 of the residency, Mr. A goes to each classroom for an hour per day. During the week, kids make an audio map of the school and talk about how the construction of the building affects the sound. They take a self-assessment listening quiz. They do a cymatics experiment, that's the study of making sound visible, using a thick starch-based solution called non-Newtonian fluid that helps students to see sound in motion. Mike puts it on a speaker and controls the frequency.
From 25 to 35, if you give it that frequency, it becomes alive. It turns like into zombie snot.
Okay, so what does zombie snot really have to do with listening? Well, it literally shows kids sound. And anyway, what's going to get kids to listen more than experimenting with a fluid you can describe as zombie snot?
5 or 6 years ago, I realized that I'm really more than a music teacher, that I'm really supposed to be teaching the kids how to listen, because no one is. You know, they're not getting cues on how to listen actively and how to pay attention to each other and what are good listening traits and bad listening traits. That's not coming from anywhere. And that's kind of why I called it Sound in Focus, because that's what I want them to focus on. I want them to refocus back on their ears.
Why does listening matter? Listening is our access to understanding. It has an impact on the way kids communicate, with each other and with the world. So how can teachers and parents better teach their kids to listen to the world around them? Mike says it can be quite simple.
Give kids opportunities to listen. Make some time in your classroom, a minute, just say, okay, we're going to be quiet right now and listen to the radiator.
That's the challenge of generations, to listen. But how else could we teach kids and adults alike to listen mindfully to become better communicators? Well, there's always public radio. For Word of Mouth, I'm Fiona Shea.
When was the last time you tried to sing in harmony? Maybe it was your elementary school music class. And many adults have not tried to draw or paint since art class. Our next guest makes the case for stretching your creative muscles, no matter your age or skill level. Get up and draw when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Being more creative is like getting more exercise. Sounds like a great goal, but who has the time? Well, artist Danny Gregory is here to tell you in the gentlest, least judgy way that everybody has the time to be an artist, including you. Gregory is co-founder of thesketchbookschool.com, which offers online art classes, and he's also author of several books, most recently Art Before Breakfast, a zillion ways to be more creative no matter how busy you are. Danny Gregory, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Yes, great to be here.
So your book is titled Art Before Breakfast, and having read it, you mean that very literally. We're supposed to draw before breakfast?
Get up 5 minutes early and have that time for yourself. For all those people who say, I have no time, you have that time.
5 minutes?
Skip brushing.
Really?
Skip, yeah, you could skip brushing your teeth.
Well, we can't condone that on the radio. I'm
sorry. No, it's just a matter of hopping out of bed because you're so excited that you're going to go and draw. It's also a matter of taking that time when perhaps the coffee is dripping or the toaster is doing its thing. You have a couple minutes, and it's possible to do a little drawing in that time. And if you do that every day, then eventually you'll start to make more time because you'll realize how cool it is to draw.
So give me a first step for a wannabe artist.
Well, get a sketchbook. It doesn't have to be an expensive or complicated sketchbook, or it could just be a notepad and a pen. I like people to draw with a pen because I think that forces you to kind of commit to what you're doing. If you draw with a pencil, you might erase it a lot. And then just look at what you're going to draw. Look at it for a minute of the five that you've devoted to this. Look at it for a minute and then slowly start to draw the outline of the edge of the thing that you're looking at. Keep your eyes about 80% of the time on the thing you're looking at, not at your drawing. And just go from there. Draw a mug of coffee. It's fascinating how you think you know what a mug of coffee looks like, but when you actually look at it and you look at the reflections, you look at the shadows, you start to see all kinds of additional things in it, and that's what makes it really interesting.
Okay, so I've got a sheet of paper and a pen in front of me right now. I've got, let's see, one, two, three, four producers in the next room who are doing the same thing. So can you walk us through a good exercise for starters?
Sure. How about drawing your hand?
Oh my.
Put your hand like loosely on the table next to you, relaxed with the palm up and the fingers kind of bent. And then put your pen on the paper. Start on the left-hand side if you're right-handed and slowly draw just the outline of what you see.
Okay, doing that.
Wow. In your idea about looking at things first, I don't think I've looked at the inside of my hand in a while.
I know. It's the irony, as we say, you know it like the back of your hand, when actually the back of your hand is something you probably never even studied. But so once you've drawn that outline, then you might want to go in and you might want to sort of indicate where the kind of wrinkly folds are in between your fingers. That's part of the interesting thing about doing this kind of observational drawing is you start to notice all these things that you'd never seen before, how many lines there are, you know, how they crisscross each other. So in a couple of minutes, you can get to know your hand an awful lot better.
So I'm getting word from the control room that Maureen, our senior producer, is not happy with her hand so far. So what would you tell Maureen right now to talk her down of scrapping the whole thing?
Well, I would say it's less about the final drawing. It's less about like, does this look like a photograph of my hand? And it's more about the journey that you're taking. So when you're first starting to draw, you know, you're doing something that it's quite possible you haven't done since you were 7 or 8 years old. And now suddenly here you are on the radio picking up a pen and doing it for the first time in decades. So, of course, you're not that great at it. So instead, what you want to concentrate on is just the experience, to quiet that voice in your mind that's telling you that you're not doing it properly. And instead, just slowly kind of get into a meditative state where you're observing these lines in your hand and you're just tracing them and copying them one at a time. It's really about that process of slowing down, observing, and recording what you're doing. So doing that 3 minutes here, 4 minutes there, a couple times a day, in a week or so, you'll have a completely transformed experience, and you'll be delighted with every single drawing you ever do for the rest of your life, I promise.
So is it all about drawing? I mean, you give us a lot of tips about drawing and getting things drawn, but, you know, that's not the only creative habit. Is this some sort of trigger or floodgate?
Yeah, I like to think of it as like a gateway sort of activity. Drawing is something that when we were little, we all did. You know, every single person on earth, when they were 4 or 5 years old, given a box of crayons, knew exactly what to do with them. And since then, we've developed a lot of resistance to this idea of drawing. And once you start to draw, you break down that resistance. Once you start to get the thrill of it and you do one drawing out of 10, perhaps, that delights you, then suddenly you'll start to think to yourself, well, what else can I do that I didn't think I could do? You know, and maybe you'll take cooking lessons next, or maybe you'll start to play the piano. There's all kinds of other things you can do, but drawing, because it's so basic, because it's something we all know how to do, even though we deny it, it's a great way to begin to break down this resistance we have to our own creativity. And it also, it doesn't involve many tools or really much time if you do it in these small increments. It's about developing a creative habit, and that habit could take you in lots of different directions. It took me all the way to going to clown school. if you can imagine such a thing. But, you know, I just sort of thought like, well, what else can I do? Because I started drawing when I was in my mid-30s, and then I discovered, wow, I actually can kind of do this, and I'm not bad at it. So then I started watercoloring, which is something I never thought I could do, and then I started learning how to bind books, and then before long I was doing all kinds of other crazy things.
Well, in the idea that this is all a journey, I'm just wondering what your takeaway was from clown school about living a creative life.
What clown school taught me was that there's a universal thing that we all have, which is we're all afraid of being foolish. And I think that that's kind of core to everything I talk about with creativity, which is we're just afraid of making mistakes. And that's something that little kids don't have. Little kids aren't terrified of being wrong. That's something we kind of pick up when we're about 9 or 10, I think. But so just letting yourself go and, you know, being willing to screw up, being willing to look foolish, being willing to learn from your mistakes, that's really how you grow. That's how you get more confident. That's how you have new adventures. So clown school taught me that remarkably quickly, that there's nothing like looking like a fool to kind of force you to rethink who you are and, you know, be a little less concerned.
You're referring in this conversation, and there's a lot of this in the book about getting into the habit, that you, as if you're building a muscle. Is there a creative muscle?
Oh, absolutely. Creativity is about forming associations between disparate things. Creativity is about overcoming your own sort of calcified preconceptions about things. So just like you just had that experience in drawing your hand where suddenly you saw it differently than you had before, you started to observe it. What you were doing there is you were overcoming this preconception that you had about what your hand looked like. If I hadn't told you to look at your hand but had just asked you to draw it, you probably could have drawn something that would look kind of like a glove. But so the process of creativity is about seeing things differently than you thought they were. And you start to change your conception of yourself and who you are. You know, suddenly you can start thinking of yourself as a creative person. You don't have to be a professional artist with a one-man show at the Guggenheim to be an artist. You can be a creative person, you know, by the way that you dress or cook dinner or doodle on the while you're on the phone. There's lots of ways to change how you think about yourself. And I think that that's the essence of creativity, is breaking down the rules. And that's how we solve problems. That's how human beings always have.
I'm speaking with the artist Danny Gregory, author of a beautifully illustrated book due out in March. He hopes will help you realize your creative self. It's called Art Before Breakfast, A Zillion Ways to Be Creative No Matter How Busy You Are. Well, you're referring to art with a capital A, I guess, rather than art with a lowercase a. What is the difference for you?
Art with a capital A is the art that we go to look at. We go to a museum, we go to a gallery, you know, it's art that's bought and sold. It's art that's made by an industry in a way. And art with a lowercase a is art that just regular people make. We make it as part of our life. It's really the difference between saying, if you said to yourself, I would like to have a grilled cheese sandwich, but I can't cook. I couldn't open a 4-star restaurant. I couldn't be like Gordon Ramsay on TV. So therefore, I'm not going to make a grilled cheese sandwich. So what I'm saying is go ahead, you know, make art in these small ways, in these ways that just kind of fit in your life, reflect your life, and don't judge them by the standards of capital A art. You're not making art that can go in a museum. You may not even be making art that can hang on a wall, maybe not even on a refrigerator. You know, you're just making it for yourself to have that experience. And it's kind of like the activity that you might have if you go to the gym. You know, there's a lot of things that you do at the gym that are activities, but they're not necessarily things that you do in your regular life. So you may not necessarily normally pick up 100-pound weight, but you do that at the gym to develop those muscles. And that's art making with a small A, is that same kind of thing. It's just this process of integrating creativity into your life without judgment, without comparison, and without anxiety, hopefully.
But we go to the gym because we're told that it's going to, you know, help us fight obesity and make our lives longer and give us more energy. Why invest time in becoming a novice at art? Why take on one more thing?
Because I think it's a primal thing. It's a core thing in what we are. I think we go to the gym to exercise because we don't have that in our natural lives anymore, right? We're sitting at desks. We're living in houses. And so we have to go to the gym in order to make up for that. Similarly, if we're living a life where we spend a lot of time looking at things that other people have made, watching TV, reading things that other people have written on our phones, we're not making, we're just consuming. But essential to being a human being is the act of making stuff. You know, we've always done it, and it is, you know, a key way that we are able to connect with the world around us. We're able to see things as they truly are rather than how we imagine them to be. It provides a stronger connection to reality. It also is relaxing. It's meditative. It strengthens your memory. It's like so many things that one can do. You just need to learn a few basic skills to do it. And the things that we usually run into, the resistance that we have, is that we feel like we can't do it. We do a drawing, it doesn't look like we thought it was going to turn out, and so we give up right away. But instead, making it part of your everyday life, by making it a regular habit, you will develop those skills remarkably quickly. That will suddenly give you a sense of mastery, and that will take you into new directions. And the more we strengthen our creative abilities, the more facile we become, the more easy we can make connections. It's all a part of really being more aware and living life on sort of a different level, I think. So in that way, and also I show you in the book how you can lose weight while while drawing, too. So if that's your concern, I'll cover that as well.
Danny Gregory, thank you very much for the encouragement.
Sure.
Danny Gregory, co-founder of SketchbookSchool.com, which offers online art classes. He's author of several books, most recently Art Before Breakfast, A Zillion Ways to Be More Creative, No Matter How Busy You Are. And you can find out more about his book and the Sketchbook School and see our in-studio sketches of our hands. Please don't judge at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to stay in the artistic realm and hear about a legendary incubator of American creativity, New York City's Chelsea Hotel. From Dylan Thomas to Patti Smith, we'll get a history of the many writers and musicians and visual artists who called the Chelsea home. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The architect of the Chelsea Hotel in New York City conceived of it as a socialist utopian commune. And indeed, it became a landmark and an incubator for creativity. The hotel's lax leasing agreements allowed artists from Jackson Pollock to Arthur Miller to Sid Vicious to live cheaply alongside other artists, writers, and musicians. Producer Sarah Fishko brings us the story of the legendary address.
Good morning, Chelsea Hotel.
The nice thing about the Chelsea Hotel is that it's there. It's still there, and it's still pretty much the same as it was when it was lived in or visited for a time by just about every creative person you can think of. In fact, so much has happened at the Chelsea, some people think there's actually something in the walls there. And if those walls could talk, or dance, or sing, or otherwise express themselves, it might be like a mass meeting in which artists of every description convene and commune.
As a composer, I feel that the more...
Aaron Copland lived at the Chelsea, for example.
Through most of history, the relationship between the artist and political power has been, how shall I say, uneasy.
Willem de Kooning spent time there, and so did Jackson Pollock.
I usually paint on the floor. I enjoy working on a large canvas. I feel more at home, more at ease.
Janis Joplin stayed there, and so did Bob Dylan.
When I was about 13 years old, all the way up till I was 19, off and on, I joined different carnivals.
And it just goes on.
You could stay for one night, for a year, or your life.
Stanley Bard is the manager of the Chelsea, as his father was before him. Stanley has spent his whole life at the Chelsea Hotel.
My father took over this hotel in 1940, and I used to come down here as a baby to see him. It was the only time I was able to see him. He was a workaholic.
It wasn't until later that he realized just whose knees he'd been bouncing on.
Arthur wrote 5 plays here. Tennessee Williams wrote 3, Thomas Wolfe, Brendan Behan. I mean, every one of these people have written, and not one thing.
It really is a staggering list.
I said, boy, and I realized that this was an important place.
The Chelsea was built in the early 1880s as an apartment house with certain remarkable characteristics.
It was built with artist studios. It was the first building to have actual artist studios with the perfect north light. That's why Sloan and Walt Kuhn and Dove, all these great Sargent, came in the early 20s and 30s. They painted here.
Writers and musicians discovered it, too, back then.
It's conducive for the writer. The walls being 3 foot thick, the hotels today, you go to the modern hotels, you can hear them whispering in the next room. Here we have 3 foot partitions separating most of the rooms. You can't hear anything. It was the tallest building in New York when it was built. In those days, it was a skyscraper.
Whenever you stay at the Chelsea Hotel, you can sense the air of greatness. The Chelsea has been home to Mark Twain, Dylan Thomas, the great Welsh poet, Brendan Behan.
Despite certain concessions to the marketplace, the Chelsea is still pleasantly shabby. Arthur Miller once referred to it as the high spot of the surreal. It still has a lobby crammed with artwork by residents, current and former, with an ornate carved mahogany mantel surrounding a central fireplace. It is the antechamber.
This is not like a normal hotel.
Jerry Weinstein runs the front desk with good nature and a master's degree in social work.
This was a temporary job till I could find a job back in social work. And that's 22 years ago.
The social work credentials come in handy.
Some people are very creative, have many problems, usually around money. If you go to any art opening or party where there are artists, I'm willing to bet that 80% of those people owe the hotel money at one time or still owe us money.
It's not just starving artists who are attracted to the place either.
Like, especially when we had these groups staying here. The other hotels wouldn't take them. The chain hotels wouldn't take them in. They said, we don't want those people with the beards or long hair or purple hair or something like that coming to their establishment. Even though I myself seem to be a conformist, I don't manage the hotel in that kind of way.
The American composer Virgil Thompson is the person everybody seems to associate with the hotel. Thompson moved in the 30s and stayed there until his death in 1989.
Virgil loved the Chelsea.
Stanley, the manager, knew him well.
He used to throw these wonderful parties. Betty Davis used to, a lot of famous people, personally, I used to go to some of them. And he never had a kitchen. He had a makeshift kitchen in a closet. My father, I remember, used to approach him every 5 years or so. He says, Virgil, let's share the cost. We'll put in a kitchen for you. No, it's not necessary. He never, ever did it. And he loved his apartment. He had a little burner, and he cooked. He was a gourmet cook. And he had these wonderful parties that he prepared all the food himself.
How did he do it?
I have no idea. Amazing man.
Thompson composed many of his portraits in the Chelsea. His piano pieces inspired by personal sittings by some of his friends and colleagues, people like Dennis Russell Davies, the conductor, and Bennett Lerner, the pianist. They'd come to his rooms in the hotel and sit, and he'd write a kind of musical evocation of them.
It comes from the intimacy that you can establish with the sitter.
He was meticulous.
There is a little space there where you can, you're not touching, but you're together.
And all his work had to be. And he wanted to die in the Chelsea Hotel. And he died in his bed. He refused to go to the hospital. Just in his sleep. A nice way to go.
That is the thing about the Chelsea Hotel. It's not a George Washington slept here kind of thing at all. Famous people passing through, it's not like that. It's not like Franz Liszt playing a piano one time and then the owner jacking up the price by calling it a Liszt piano. The Chelsea is the real thing. Real work was done there and is still being done. Real attachments were made there and are still being made.
They tell me there are ghosts in the walls, there are ghosts in the elevators.
I have tricks in my pocket. I have things up my sleeve. I give you truth in the pleasant disguise.
I rather think that I take you a creative person needs to live in an atmosphere where he feels good, a serene place, a spiritual place.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rage.
The Chelsea Hotel enters its 125th year in 2007.
Yes, that's America, off Jersey coast. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no cause for alarm.
If its walls could talk, you might hear tributes and toasts across generations.
People seem to do their best work here, whether it be music, art, or drama. It just seems to bring out the best in them. That's part of the mystique of the Chelsea. People keep coming back here and keep creating here.
From the Fishko Files, I'm Sarah Fishko.
That story was produced by Sarah Fishko and is now a piece of history in and of itself. Stanley Bard was ousted as manager of the Chelsea Hotel by the heirs of two other ownership families. The Chelsea then sold to a real estate magnate and later to King & Grove, a trendy boutique hotel chain currently overseeing a $40 million renovation. Some accuse the new owners of hazardous construction practices and illegal art seizures. Last year, Ed Sheets, CEO of King & Grove, rebranded his entire hotel group, Chelsea Hotels, after the legendary Bohemian enclave. The company's website says the new name reflects the philosophy of the iconic hotel and is centered on the idea of creativity, community, and shared experience.
I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for listening. If you missed any of the show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. Now, don't forget, last week we spoke with Amy Diaz from The Hippo about categories notably absent from the Academy Awards, and we came up with some of our own imaginary awards that we have dubbed the WAMIs. Well, there is still time to cast your vote. You'll find the ballot and clips from all the nominees at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And tune in for our Sunday show at noon when we announce the winners. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Just turn your back on the crowd. You got a way I never once heard you say. I need you. I don't need you.